The following podcast is a production of Institutional Real Estate Incorporated. For the most comprehensive industry news and information, visit our website at irei.com and sign up for our free daily news alerts.
My guest is Angus Baker, an executive with Montego Minerals. Among Mr. Baker's areas of expertise are 1031 exchanges for properties containing oil and gas and mineral rights. He has been directly involved in close to $1 billion divested into the marketplace, including 1031 oil, gas, and mineral exchanges. We're going to talk in some detail about this asset class, which many investors know little or nothing about. Angus Baker, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Mike. Thank you very much.
Hey, it's good to have you here. And one of the things I noticed is a piece of information that I picked up off your website, as a matter of fact. It says the United States is the only country in the world that allows private citizens to own mineral rights. And the rest of the world, mineral rights are owned by that country's government. That came as a bit of a surprise. Not surprising that the United States allows for this, because we that's pretty well understood. But I was a little surprised that no other country in the world, because there's an awful lot of open marketplaces, open economies in the world. How did this come to pass just in the United States?
Well, if you think about it, as a landowner, you know, back in 1920 when it all started, there had to be some motivation for a person who owned a beautiful piece of property to allow somebody to come in and I'll use the word tear up the property. They don't typically tear it up, but they have to build roads and they have to build pads and they have to put in pump jacks. So there had to be some motivation for the landowner, who was typically back then the subsurface owner as well, and they are severed. Please remember that not always does the surface owner own the subsurface. Because over the years, they've stripped it away and kept it and sold the surface. So there has to be a way for the surface owner to allow free enterprise to come in and produce commercially a product from their land, and that's how they established the royalty or the minerals.
So let's, that being the case, let's talk about 1031 exchanges specifically for oil and gas and mineral rights on properties. Why don't you outline how this works, Angus? How does this take place? Maybe you can kind of outline a typical deal.
Well, let me go back to the beginning of my career, because I was with a company in Dallas, Texas that was kind of the first company to really take the cash flow from the production of oil and gas in the light of royalties or minerals and make that a product. Up until that point, most of the minerals and royalties across the U.S. was, for lack of a better word, being hoarded by high net worth families, major landowner families, industry insiders into the oil and gas business. A typical layman, a non-sophisticated oil and gas person, really didn't have the opportunity to purchase this asset class. So in 2003, or it actually started in 1997, I joined this company in 2003. And in 2005, we actually established, there were 1031s going on for many, many decades. But what people were doing is people were going from bricks and mortar real estate or land surface to other surface or to other bricks and mortar real estate. Well, when you look at the qualifications of what subsurface is, it's by the IRS, it's considered non-possessory real estate. And the fact that it's real estate qualifies someone to sell an apartment complex or a strip center or a rental house and use the code, tax code 1031 exchange, to defer the gains on the sale and roll over into another real estate venture. And we actually got a title opinion on this, and it did qualify. And from about 2005 forward, the company that I was with started really doing a lot of 1031 activity, because if you remember correctly, in 2005 we were approaching, we were just a few years short of approaching the bubble. There were people all over America that had $2 million real estate properties that they paid $200,000 for 20 years ago or 30 years ago, and all of a sudden they were looking down the barrel of Uncle Sam's gun at a $1.8 million tax burden because they had depreciated their cost basis down to zero, and now they were looking at, you know, long-term capital gains on $1.8 million. So that really motivated a lot of people, not to mention that they could roll it over into minerals and royalties, which at that time the value of that asset class was consistently producing 10% and upwards. And all of a sudden now you could see people saying, okay, I can defer the tax. I can now roll it over into a producing income monthly, by the way, just like their rent was in their real estate. And I can defer my tax dollars and have cash flow, not only on the principal, but also on the dollars that I would have paid Uncle Sam. So it became a very, very, very highly motivated movement for people to go from bricks and mortar or from surface to subsurface.
Okay, so I can imagine, Angus, some investors saying, oil and gas, that sounds risky. It's a, people might think of terms like wildcatting and such. Obviously, you're not talking about that. But oil goes up and oil goes down in price, and as we've seen, it can go quite low. And I'm sure this has had an impact. Do you find that some investors feel that if they're getting into the space of oil and gas and minerals, that they're moving into a risky investment? Is there any pushback on that or any questioning of that? And what kind of risks do exist in this space?
Well, sometimes when you say oil and gas, Mike, it gives the whole industry, it tends to give the whole industry a black eye, because there's a lot of horror stories out there about investment dollars going into drilling programs with the motivation of being able to get a tax advantage on that investment, and that's a dollar for dollar, 100% of what you invest typically is tax deductible, and that does wonders for people to offset taxes. The problem is with that is sometimes that that motivation doesn't create, or that project that they invest in doesn't create an income. So, and I get this question a lot when I'm speaking in front of hundreds of people. Typically, every one of them in the room are smarter than I am, and they always ask me, because the person speaking right before me typically offered a tax advantage. And my only answer is to come back and say, listen, we're not in the business of giving tax credits. We're in the business of giving 1099s. I think you can figure this one out. The royalty and mineral space is a very conservative place. As a matter of fact, I'll tell you how conservative it is. Institutions or endowments like Stanford and Harvard and Yale, they have hundreds of millions of dollars worth of minerals and royalties. Now, I'm not sure if you know the mentality, the investment mentality of those institutions, but risk is not an option. They're looking for something very low risk. Typically, they're happy in the 4, 5, 6, 7, 8% range as a return on investment. Excuse me. That helps them subsidize their scholarship programs. And if you think about too, how many very wise and intelligent people graduated from those as alumni and went back to sit on the endowment boards. It didn't take them long to figure out that the petroleum engineers and those who were involved in oil and gas said, hey, you know, if you want to diversify and you want to find something that creates cash flow, minerals and royalties are a great place to do that. And we typically see when you're involved in buying a property for sale that is $50 million, $60 million, up to $100 million, you'll be really, really shocked at who shows up in the crowd to purchase that. It's typically people with a very conservative mindset. Here's the reason it's conservative. There are only two risks in buying minerals and royalties. Two. Just two. It is the gross production, which is coming from the ground, typically always already producing, and the price of oil and gas. So we could talk forever about why you should be long-term bullish on the price of oil and gas, but the one thing that's most important is that supply and demand has control, long-term control, not short-term control, because I understand that a war or a winter, spring, summer, fall, or season would be a hype, speculation, fear, geopolitical, all those things manipulate the price of oil and gas, but those manipulate the price of oil and gas short-term. What really moves the price of oil and gas is supply and demand. Supply is finding more, demand is using more. And if you look back, since 1970, the world population has almost doubled. But the use of electricity, which is typically controlled by oil, natural gas, or coal, has gone up exponentially. I don't even know, 100 times. Because you have countries that used no electricity back in the 70s and now use an abundance of. Unlike countries here in the U.S. that use a lot today, yes, we're going to use more 10 years from now, but we're not going to use substantially more. You take a country like India who used none in 1970 and now is lit up like a Christmas tree at nighttime. That really puts a dent in supply. So you take the population doubling in 46 years on the world, and now you look at current population growth and the percentage that is growing by now, and you will see that in 15 or 20 more years it's going to double again. So anytime the population grows, demand for energy, and by the way, it's not just energy that they use oil for. Everything in your office, the clothes you wear, the cars you drive, all that stuff is petroleum-based. Crayons that kids use in school, it's all petroleum-based. So it doesn't have to necessarily be electrical because manufacturing does it, industrial does it. Everything touches oil. So as population grows, the demand soars. Now let's go back over to supply. And this is something we've seen over the last several years since 2014, when the price of oil and gas, the price of oil went from 100 down into 28 in that year, from March to December. So what happened in supply? Well, if you drive through Midland, Texas today, you'll typically see every yard, which is the surface area that contains all the equipment for every oil and gas company as far as you can see driving down I-20, the yards are full. There's no place to put any more equipment. And that's because in a lot of that business, they kind of shut down when the price gets to a certain point. So when that slowdown or that shutdown occurs, all of a sudden supply starts screaming the other direction, declining, if you will. As demand continues to increase, the supply decreases. So it doesn't take very long for those to balance and or pass each other, and all of a sudden prices start to rise again. So I think based solely on price, it's controlled by supply and demand. So let me touch briefly on the other risk, and that's gross production, and that's our job at Montego. That's what we do. That's our expertise. So when someone brings us a property and says, hey, would you be interested in buying a portion? Now remember, we don't buy 100% of what everybody owns. Typically, sellers will sell a percentage, 10, 20, 30, 40, 50. and all we do is try to take pieces of, because we're not necessarily trying to take somebody completely out of their position. So when we go to evaluate a property, we will, the first thing we will do is we will ask to see a production curve. That production curve goes back typically to the beginning of the production, and it looks like an EKG, if you will, of a person in the hospital. And I'm sorry I have to use this analogy, but it's the best one. The greatest stable properties look like the EKG of a person who's died. And that shit, it just goes flat across the page. The production curve of a growing property will be on an incline curve. And the production curve of a declining property will be on a decline. And you can see that with your naked eye. And remember, it's gross production. It doesn't tell us how profitable it was. It just tells us every drop of oil and gas that came out of the ground, because as a royalty owner, and here's the beauty, here's the number one beauty of being a mineral owner, is that we get paid off of the gross, not the net. And I tell people all over the country, how would you like to run your business that way? How would you like to not have to pay expenses and still get paid on all the revenue? Well, that's what we do. And all the growth and all the maintenance and all the new exploration and all the new wells drilled in the future, which is another characteristic we'll talk about briefly, is paid by the working interest owner. And we participate in the success, but not in the failure. So if a well doesn't work, it costs the royalty owner nothing. If a well does work, then we participate at our undivided interest in the revenue. And then we look at diversification. We try to spread it out so that we're geographically diversified. We don't want to be in one spot under one operator. We want multiple operators in multiple geographical regions. Why? Because we want a portion of each operator. They have a CapEx budget every single year to maintain or increase their production or their reserves. And every time they drill a new well and it's proven, they step out and prove up more reserves. So their motivation is to keep drilling and to keep producing. And we like to have multiple people doing it at one time, because when that happens, the gross production number increases. And remember, our yield increases based on two things: gross production and price. So when price goes up, production goes up. We're getting a double bonus based on those two things. If price goes down and production goes up, they offset each other. If both go down, then our yield goes down too. But over my experience in the business, I love to say this, is that there is a lot of serendipity in the business, but typically oil and gas will go up and down, but it won't go goodbye. And I've been in other investments in my career that did go goodbye. And needless to say, I don't have any more of those. I'm 100% in oil and gas and royalties. So we also, the last thing I want to talk about in the risk is it is true. It is true that every single well in America declines from the day it's drilled. Some decline rapidly. Some decline slowly. There are wells that are drilled in Midland, Texas that have been producing since the 40s and 50s, and they still produce today. That's a slow decline rate. When you see shell plays, typically the production from the what they call the IP, the initial production from the day they started recording it, can decline 70, 80, 90% in a 2 or 3 year period. And then it's called a hyperbolic curve, and then it settles into a long-term consistent rate. So that's typically when a royalty owner goes in, is when it's not as sexy anymore to those who were being paid off the net, and we know there's a long life ahead of it with very stable and low decline. So we actually engineer, because at Montego, everybody that is a principal at Montego is an engineer, so we don't have to send out for third party. We do all of our own engineering, not to mention we've been embedded into the Permian Basin and Midland for over 60 years as a family. So we we typically get a lot of our information at lunch or at the office or sitting in the pew at church or having happy hour at Petroleum Club or RT or next door neighbor. So we're not necessarily buying from someone who's on the open market, who's marked it up or who it's gone through a couple of hands and the fees are kind of stacked on. We're typically buying off the radar, off the market, with the network that we've been embedded in for over 60 years. So I like to think that minerals and royalties are very conservative, but I also like to think that the way we buy at Montego reduces several layers of risk as well for those investors.
Where are these properties? Are we talking about the basins around the United States?
Typically where we focus our 100% of our time is the Permian Basin. That's our home. That's what we know. I will tell you that that's the highest place in America to buy. That is where when the country shut down in drilling, I think at one point there were maybe 320 or 30 rigs, the lowest point we got to during the slowdown. And 75 or 80% of those rigs were in the Permian Basin. So we like to stay in our neck of the woods, if you will. However, we like to venture over into East Texas as well, because that's a natural gas play. And natural gas has been, the nose of natural gas got bloodied 10 years ago, and the prices stayed down. When oil has gone up and down, the price of natural gas has stayed down. So we see some very, very good, stable properties that are diversified and that have longevity and that have growth components to them, but the sellers are distressed.
Are these investments, you indicated earlier, these investments are really for both institutional and individual investors, is that right?
Absolutely.
Okay, let me ask you this then. If I'm a high net worth individual, what is the minimum I'm going to end up spending to play in that market?
I would turn around and ask somebody a question on a question. How much do you want to get out of it? Let's just say, I'm just going to pick a number, it's typically true, that I can almost guarantee or I can find properties that will produce 10% return. So if you want $500 a month, or $5,000 a year, then you need to invest $50,000 to achieve that. You see, what we see is people, most of the clients that come to us are in what we call wealth preservation mode. They've already made a lot of money, and now they want to figure out how to save it, if you will, or get the best return on investment, if you will. And also, there are people who use this asset class as an estate planning tool. And we can talk more a little bit about that. But I always like to say, if you're in your 40s or 50s and you know you're going to retire soon, start taking small bites of the apple and building bulk or diversifying. It's the same thing a mutual fund is to a single stock. It's the same thing a REIT is to a single piece of real estate. You take small bites of minerals and royalties along the way, and you're building your well count, you're building your acreage, you're building how many operators there are, you're building geographically, you're building you're building the growth component. So I wouldn't want somebody, if they were going to invest $1 million and they thought that $1 million would throw off $100,000 a year and that would satisfy their life, their living style, their lifestyle, the one that they had before they actually quit working, I would say I would take $100,000 bites or $200,000 bites of multiple properties versus putting $1 million into one property. It's just more and more diversification, which that word basically speaks, you know, lack of risk by doing it. So,
okay, let me stop you there, Angus, and ask you this question. Let's talk about the estate planning tool. We have a lot of ultra high net worth families that are readers of this publication, or their advisors are readers of the publication, and meaning Real Assets Advisor magazine. In a case like that, give us a scenario. I mean, give us an example of a family that would take advantage of a 1031 exchange for oil, gas, and mineral rights and use it as a tool for the wealth preservation and that family planning tool, the family trust, or what have you.
I have a perfect example. But before I tell you the example, I want to spit out a couple of names of families who are some of the largest mineral and royalty owners in America today.
Okay.
The Rockefellers are number one. The Hearst, the Vanderbilts, the Kennedys, the Fords, Ted Turner. These are people who gobbled up mass plots of land over time by thinking that their real estate investment was going to preserve their wealth. And it ended up that their minerals and royalties were more valuable than the surface itself. So those are a few of the families who own the majority, a lot of royalties and minerals. But let me give you one specific client. It was a family of seven, six girls, one boy. He had a commercial airline pilot's job.
Who's he? Is this the father?
This was the father. And the mother was in retail. And they ended up building their retail stores. And as most good real estate people do, they end up owning their real estate and not paying rent. So they ended up building their retail chain to five or six stores around the state of Texas. And all of a sudden, years down the road, the husband became sick and couldn't fly commercially anymore. So this was their sole income. And they ended up creating a very successful business. And the husband eventually became ill. And it looked like his life expectancy was short. So as that family learned more and more about royalties and minerals, starting back in 2003, they started making investments into the space. And their investments were anywhere from $50,000 to a couple of million dollars. And when I say a couple of million, that was the time that they used the 1031 code. They ended up selling their business, and then they kept the real estate. So they got lump sum from the sale of the business. They took the lump sum money from the sale and started investing into minerals and royalties. And then years down the road, they ended up selling the real estate, and they used the 1031 code to defer their tax. So now they have approximately $3 million invested into royalties and minerals, and the father's about to pass away, and the father says, okay, they've put all these minerals and royalties into a trust. And it simply means that in a trust, that when both parents pass, the heirs are now owners of the trust. And the minerals will bleed off income for still that let me briefly tell you the characteristics of what they built over time. They have over 25,000 producing wells now across the U.S. 25,000 wells that are producing income every single day. Those wells are sitting on 1.5 million gross acres. They're geographically diversified over 21 states. There is land that's not producing today that will produce in the future. So there's a huge growth component to it. And they're very well diversified. Over 500 different operators are operating, maintaining, and exploring on their 1.5 million acres. So their $3 million throws off around $30,000 a month. It goes down when the prices go down. It's been down as low as $15,000 a month. It's been as high as $45,000 a month, $50,000 a month. But their main concern was that upon death of both parents, that the kids would not get lump sum, because it took them 30 years to build their wealth. And they weren't sure, of the seven kids, who would be responsible or not responsible. As a matter of fact, they even said to me, I know that two or three of them would be broke within a year if they got their hands on the principal or the lump sum. So it's all sitting in a trust. They're welcome to enjoy the revenue after we pass. And someone who is the executor of the trust or will distribute the income to each sibling each month. And upon death of those people, it'll be then passed on to the great-grandkids. So those families that I mentioned in the very beginning, that was their motivation. That was 100% of their motivation, is to preserve the family's wealth, because it doesn't take but one bad apple to come down the pipe that gets their hands on lump sum to squash what took decades for granddad and dad and great-granddad to possibly build. And I think it's one of the most responsible ways and one of the most, if not the most, motivational issues as to why people should consider minerals and royalties.
Let's talk about how a person gets paid if they've invested, they've done the 1031 exchange, they've got mineral, oil, and gas rights. That money is then reinvested into the property, or can I draw on that? If I'm drawing on it, I'm paying taxes on it, I'm assuming. Tell me what how the investor actually gets paid.
Well, what happens is there's in the 1031 world, there is what's called a qualified intermediary. And if a person knows they're about to sell a piece of real estate, they contact or they fill out a form that says to the IRS that I'm going to invoke my rights of using 1031 exchange upon the sale of the real estate that I'm about to put on the market. Okay? So once that real estate sells, they have, by law, 45 days to identify the replacement property that they're going to take the proceeds from the sale and roll into something new. If any of that money comes off the table, it's a taxable event at long-term capital gains, assuming they've held it that long and assuming that there's no depreciation left. So any money coming off the table is a taxable event. Any money going to the qualified intermediary sets and waits until the sale of the property closes. Then the funds go to the QI, or it sets in an escrow account. And then the new property is identified, and the money goes from the escrow of the QI into the person who is the seller of the new replacement property. And it doesn't mean it has to be one property. When you use the 1031 code, you can identify up to three properties, or you can identify up to 200% of the total amount of money being exchanged. So, and then after you've identified, you have 180 days to close on the new property. So it's and once that closes, and the person selects the replacement properties, the funds are then sent to the seller of the replacement properties, and then whatever income is coming off of the replacement properties flows into whatever is holding the asset. If it's a individual person, then it goes right straight to their bank account, either through and it's paid monthly. Typically, oil and gas and minerals are paid monthly. Some people will pay quarterly, only because that helps save the expense of consolidating a lot of checks and distributing a lot of checks. It sometimes can be an accounting nightmare if there are hundreds of investors in a property. So it might be easier and more efficient economically to do it monthly, but the operators pay the royalty and mineral owners every single month.
Now, as an investor, I go after a property. How do I know that that property isn't going to run out of the minerals, natural gas, oil, whatever it's producing? At some point, you acknowledged this earlier, that a well always, you know, a well runs down eventually. So how do I know that I'm getting into a property that's going to continue to produce versus, you know, hey, 6 months into it, it's been spent?
Well, typically, if a well is new and it only lasted 6 months, they won't be drilling there much longer. Okay. Typically, the people that are drilling in America are drilling in places where they know that the production is going to last decades. If someone's drilling in an area where the production is not has not been verified to produce for decades, then they're more in the exploration mode, not development. But typically, the first step you do is you look back at a production curve to see how long has it been lasting, and you look to see how many wells it's grown to, what's the well count from the inception of the property, and then you look at and what we do at Montego to help offset decline is what we call that growth component. We try to go out and get minerals not only on the land that's producing, but the land that is surrounding the production are in the path of the production. For instance, here's a great example. We just in Fund 3 acquired a piece of property that's 6,000 acres in size. One contiguous piece of property sitting in, and all the people that are investors in Fund 3 own their undivided interest in this 6,000 acres. The production on the acreage right now is minimal. It's probably 1%, 2%. But what we've learned through our network and through our contacts is that this 6,000 acres is about to be drilled by a couple of very large oil and gas companies in Midland, Texas. I can mention the names, Pioneer and Endeavor. Inside information in our business is legal, by the way, so I'm not going to get any trouble by knowing what's going to happen in the future. Only in the equities market will you get in trouble for divulging that kind of information. So it's part of our process. It's part of our acquisition process to use every method we have and all of our resources that we have to know what's happening. You can do it because oil and gas information is public. I can look up tomorrow where every drilling rig in America is if I want to. It's out there. I can go to railroad commissions and I can find the production of every single well in America, what it produced the last time it was recorded. Typically, it's in the rears by 30 or 60 days. But all oil and gas production is public information. That's why it's not illegal to know what's happening. So when you see people building pipelines, they don't build pipelines on speculation. They build pipelines because something major is about to happen in the future. When people sell assets and move resources to another area, you can track that movement. So we know where, not to mention we are in the, you know, the Permian Basin has the second largest reserves in the world today behind Saudi Arabia, and that's if you assume Saudi Arabia is being accurate on their recordings, which many people don't believe. But the Permian Basin has been watched and explored and examined now for well over 100 years, and they are actually saying that because of new pay zones found in the Permian Basin, which is a depth of a property underneath the ground that are stacked on top of each other. Some might be hundreds of feet thick, some might be thousands of feet thick, but they are containing hydrocarbons that have not been produced. So those are future targets for areas that have been producing for 100 years to maybe the shallow production stops. They can now go in and drill down to deeper zones and start to drain the hydrocarbons, oil, and gas from those zones as well. And they're saying that the Permian Basin has up to 10 new zones that are proven to contain hydrocarbons that are not producing at this time. On this 6,000-acre piece of property I was talking about, there is a formation called the Wolf Camp. The Wolf Camp is proven now to contain over 4 billion barrels of oil. And each well that's drilled has an EUR, which is estimated ultimate recovery, of 1 million barrels per well. So on this 6,000 acreage, Endeavor or Pioneer can drill somewhere in the neighborhood of 199 new wells in the future. So that's going to take Pioneer or Endeavor up to 14 years to drill those wells, drilling at 11, 12 wells per year. It's going to take them 14 years to drill that whole 6,000 acres. So all that new production that's coming online is going to be the way that it offsets some of the old production going offline. Now, the Permian's not quite like that. The shale plays are more like you just talked about. New wells coming on and having steep declines, and how do I offset that decline? It's simply by drilling new wells. So you have to have that growth component. You have to have that raw acreage, and you have to have it, you know, typically we'll have it, it could be 30 to 40% of the portfolio land that's not producing that we have strong evidence to believe it'll produce in the future.
So let me ask you, how long does a typical investor actually, I don't even know if you can answer this, Angus, but how long is the typical hold time on those properties before a person will divest?
You won't believe this, but as you mentioned in your opening statement, in your introduction, that $1 billion that I've been directly or indirectly involved in placing in the market over 15 years has come from over 3,000 clients. I've had three people sell. Three. And the reason why is because, A, we've been in a period where they can't find a yield anywhere else. The globe has been starving for a yield now for a decade, and money's flocking to any place that will produce some sort of yield. And when they see it, they used to call it mailbox money, because it would show up in your mailbox every 30 days, and that becomes that's a very addictive thing, going to your mailbox every 30 days to see what your check is. So people start to say, well, so if I do sell it, where am I going to put it? And there's not another place to really, you know, without taking more risk, which is always an option. If you want to put it back in the market, say the market's gone down and you think now it's time to come in and out. But I will tell you that almost 99% of the people that invest in minerals and royalties have a long-term hold mentality. Now, that being said, that doesn't mean you can't sell it. You're more than welcome to sell it, because in some of the properties that I've sold in the past have come in a structure that's called direct title, which means just like your home or just like your car or any other piece of real estate, you have the title to it, and it's of public record. So you're more than welcome to take the title and go find a buyer. There's auction houses that happen every month. There are some 70 different divestiture firms or brokers, if you will, in America that would be more than happy for a comparable fee as the selling real estate, 3 to 6%. Package your product, market your product, negotiate your product to the thousands, if not tens of thousands, of buyers in the country. So you can sell, but I think your question was, how long do I have to hold it till I can sell? And
well, not so much that, because I understand that there's not that. It's a different sort of investment. I was just really more curious about the fact that there doesn't seem to be a compelling reason to sell necessarily. That's kind of what I was thinking in terms of, and at what point does somebody find reason to pull out? Of the people, the three people who were clients of yours who pulled out, what were the reasons for eventually liquidating?
They had an emergency and they needed their cash.
Okay, let me ask you a final question here. You got a 1,000-acre tract of land. You're selling mineral rights and oil and gas rights. How many people, is that predetermined how many people can buy into that? Because if I have bought into it at a certain price, I don't want my stake diminished by throwing the doors open and letting all different flavors of investors through that door, and then suddenly I have a smaller and smaller check coming in each month. What are the rules around that?
Well, whatever you invest the day you invest is your total. Once a property is fully funded, it's closed. There are no new investors coming in and out. So you can never be diluted in minerals and royalties by more money coming in. There's only X amount of dollars available, and once that dollar amount is reached, that property is closed and not available until somebody else that owns that property in the future is willing to sell it. So whatever you own day one is what you own for life, and however long you keep it, you can expect to receive, you know, based on price fluctuation, you can expect to receive your undivided interest each and every month for the life of the property.
Angus Baker, thank you for coming on the program.
You're very welcome. Thank you for having me.